Blog Talk Radio.
Denise Griffiths is your partner in success. Tune in each Friday as virtual assistants, industry expert, web developer, and online entrepreneur Denise Griffiths interviews industry experts from one end of the internet to the other. These expert entrepreneurs freely share their business building knowledge and provide practical guidance that will show you how to build and grow your own very successful business, be it online or traditional brick and mortar. Now, ladies and gentlemen, your partner in success, Denise Griffiths.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show. Today, I am really delighted to welcome back one of my favorite authors and personalities. And when I say personalities, that's in capital letters. And that personality is Larry Wingate. And to tell you the truth, I'm not convinced that Larry actually needs an introduction, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about him anyway. Larry is known as the pit bull of personal development and the world's only irritational speaker. Larry isn't interested in stoking egos or telling trite parables or making anybody feel good about their lack of success. His attitude is, your success is your issue. You have to deal with it. You have to create it. Larry is a five-time New York Times bestselling author, television personality, and award-winning personal speaker. And today he's here to share with us how you can fix your own economy and change your financial circumstances. So good morning, Larry, and welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, I love chatting with you. I get the biggest kick out of you. I really do. I read your stuff. I was reading your blog this morning. And, you know, I follow you around on Facebook, and we chat there. And I'm telling you, some of the things that you say just have me going, whoa. Oh, yeah, he's right. Whoa.
So, I have a lot of people respond that way. If you follow on Facebook, you know, I can fire them up.
I know. And I'm in there right in the middle of it half the time. So, listen, it is no secret that the economy is bad and people are scared to death right now. And my take is that they're also very angry. So what are the steps, and probably difficult steps, that people need to take in order to control their own economy? And don't mince words. Just tell us what you really think.
Well, you know, I don't believe they are scared to death, and I don't think they're angry enough.
You
don't? I really don't, because they keep spending. You know, we still have about half the country spending more money than they make. So they're not mad enough or afraid enough to stop the spending. Some people are, and I applaud those folks. But the key is you do have to, what you said, worry about your own economy and not get so caught up in the economy. What can you do? We need to go back to the basics from a government standpoint and from a personal standpoint. You buy what you can afford to buy. You go in debt what you can afford to pay off. And if you don't have the cash, do without it right now. And sadly, we're still not there for most people. When you look at the shopping that's going on right now, and shopping's up this year, I watch all the interviews. People say, well, I'm just real encouraged. The recession is over. Is it really? I can't tell. And you got to be careful that you don't get sucked into the it's over. And, you know, they didn't talk about it being over until we were going into the holiday season in order to affect the retail numbers. You got to be careful thinking that it's over and going out and getting caught in the trap of what people have typically been caught in for the last 10 to 15 years. Of overspending at Christmas. Most people open up their credit card bills right now, and they're still paying off last year's Christmas.
Mm-hmm. I know people like that, actually. I'm not one of them, but I do know people.
Well, there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah. You know what I've always wondered is how, when you know, and maybe you have the answer to this, because I know you talk with a lot of people about money, but when you know good and well you just don't have it, I mean, you don't have the money in your wallet to go buy that latte, or you don't have the money to go buy your child a little motorized scooter that he wants or whatever it is. Why do they do it? What is the psychology behind that?
Well, we do have a society right now based on entitlement, and they really think that whether they have the money or not, they deserve to have those things. And I actually get emails from people that say, I deserve to have those things whether I have the money or not. And I bang my head against the wall trying to figure out how people have gotten to the point that they think they deserve something they can't afford to pay for. But when you look at the, they call them the 99ers right now, the people who have been on unemployment for 99 weeks, the most hate mail I ever got was over that issue, saying that it would be better to take a job earning $350 a week than to stay on unemployment at $400 a week. I got hate mail over that. I got a death threat over saying that on television.
Are you kidding?
No,
see, that's
curious.
Actually on my list to talk to you about was I wanted to know what I know what I think about this unemployment extension crap. I'm just going to say, or as you know, John Boehner says, it's chicken crap. But I know what I think of it. What do you think of it? Is it harmful or is it helpful? Not just to the economy, not just to our deficit, but what does it do to the people
it's
who are 99
horrible.
Months?
Yeah, if in 99 weeks you haven't been able to find a job, you weren't looking very hard for a job. And I know people who really do think that they deserve to get their $400 a week, and some people it's more than that, some people it's less than that, rather than go out and actually take a job and earn the money. And it does, what people don't seem to understand is that the best time to get a job is when you already have a job. And there are jobs available. I guarantee if we cut the 99 weeks down to 6 weeks, it would be amazing how many of those 15 million people could find something to do for a living. Because why?
Something.
They had to.
They have to, right. And you can create something. I mean, American entrepreneurship is not dead.
No, it's not. I spoke to a checkout girl at the local PetSmart as I was buying my dog some dog food, and she said, well, I'm on my way to my third job. We were just chatting back and forth, and I said, three jobs? You have three jobs? How can you have three jobs when 15 million people don't have one job? And she just laughed, and she said, you know, there's always something if you're willing to do anything. And I thought, that is the most profound statement I've heard this year. There is always something if you're willing to do anything. Sadly, we've reached the point, again, of entitlement that people are not willing to do whatever it takes in order to work.
I agree with you. In fact, on the news, anytime I'm listening to the news or watching it, and that word entitlement pops up, I'm going to break a molar one day, I promise you. My teeth just snap together. Entitlement? You're entitled to make a living is what you're entitled to do.
Well, you know, I wrote a lot about that and took a lot of flack over that, but that's what I agree, that you're entitled to go out and earn a living. But when you have 50% of our society right now in America who are receiving monies from some sort of entitlement program, and then you have another 50% who don't pay any taxes at all, that is a formula for disaster, and that's where we are.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you hear these people, and I'm sure that you have this thought process when you get emails from people say, well, I deserve to have 99 weeks of unemployment. Who the heck do they think is paying that? I mean, where do they think the money
paying.
Is going to come? When the money runs out, where's that money going to come from if nobody's working? I think the thought processes that go on in these arguments, these specious arguments that I hear, they're not logical, and I worry about the mentality. I worry about the mental health, to be honest with you, people who think that way.
Well, I have friends who want to argue with me about how cold I am about many of the social programs that are out there and taking care of people who are sick and feeding people and on and on and on. And I say, you know, I have as big a heart as anybody. I don't want anybody on this planet to suffer. Just tell me how we're going to pay for it. That if we can figure out a way to pay for it, I'm for doing everything anybody wants to do, as long as you can afford to do it. And that's really what comes down to on a world level, on a government level, and certainly on a personal level. Do whatever you want to as long as you can afford to do it. And if you can't afford to do it, then you got to change your want-tos.
There you go. And I don't think a lot of people understand how that works. So can you expand a little bit on change your want-tos and maybe some tips for doing that? I mean,
simple, and I think if I was ever given a gift, it's the ability to simplify things. It's so bottom line. Figure out, and this is one thing people never do, figure out how much money you got. Figure out what you owe. Subtract what you owe from what you've got, and hopefully you come up with a positive number. If you don't come up with a positive number, then you have to adjust your lifestyle so you can. It's really that basic and that simple. Now, the best tool for managing your life, including your finances and your parenting skills and your relationships and your jobs and every area of your success, including your health and your weight and everything, is a pencil. And most people just never pick one up. Pick up a pencil and some paper and start to write some things down to figure out where you are. This is the most simplified success formula in the world is this. Figure out where you are, figure out where you want to be, and then figure out what you're going to give up to go from where you are to where you want to be. Most people focus too much on how am I going to get more success. You don't get more success. You give up what's keeping you from being successful. You don't get rich. You give up what's keeping you broke. You don't get skinny. You give up what's keeping you fat. So what are you going to give up? All these motivational bozos out there who tell you that you can get what you want. No, you can't. You got to give up everything you're doing that's keeping you from getting what you want. I'm big into give up. I'm very much a believer in negative attitude. You got to get negative about your life before you can make positive change in your life. I'm much more about the sacrifice and becoming uncomfortable. And then it goes back to that ugly, nasty, caustic, filthy, horrible four-letter word, work.
Work. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have laughed at that. But
listen, that's the dirtiest word in our language today, work.
It does appear to be, and I find that enormously sad. I really do. But you're so right, and I have to be honest with you, I was listening very intently to what you were just saying, and I had never really thought of it in quite those terms. I mean, logically, I probably know it, but I hadn't settled on those particular sentence structures that you have to give something up. You have to get uncomfortable. You have to stop doing what you're doing that's preventing you from getting where you need to be. That is immensely profound, and you know, I thank you for
I think so, too. I appreciate that. Listen, I realized a few years ago that my entire philosophy of success, and I have written five bestsellers based on this philosophy, it's based on the old joke. The guy goes to the doctor and says, hey, doctor, it hurts when I do this. And the doctor says, then don't do that. Mm-hmm. All you have to do in your life is figure out what you're doing that hurts you and stop doing it. And when you keep removing the things that hurt you, you're left with the things that help you. That's all you have to do. You don't have to do more of anything. You have to do less of the stupid stuff that you're doing in your life.
Mm-hmm. And that makes absolute perfect sense. It's probably too simple for some people.
You know, and that is the problem. People don't ultimately want their success strategies to be simple. They really do want them to be complicated, because if they buy into the idea that success is complicated, that being rich is hard, that living a good life and having great relationships is nearly impossible, if they buy into that kind of thinking, then they'll have excuses for not doing well. I just try to remove the excuses.
Well, what are some steps that people can take? I mean, let's just do a what if. Let's say we've got somebody that, well, let's start with a job. You know, they just lost their job. Let me give you one that I actually know somebody. She knew for a year that her job was being outsourced to India. A year. Knew it was going to be outsourced to India. Doesn't have a job now and is losing her home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it. I don't.
And I also don't feel a lot of compassion. I know I'm terrible.
No,
I just don't feel a lot of compassion.
Because
she knew for a year.
I'm not jumping over hoops to help. Yeah, I'm not doing anything I can to help other than lend an ear every now and then or basically pull a Larry and go, and what are you going to do about it? You know?
Exactly. Exactly. You see, that's a person who needs help but doesn't want help. I learned a long time ago in the personal development industry and doing what I do, I never help people who need help. It's a waste of your time. I help people who genuinely want help. People who need help rarely do anything with it. People who want help will do something with it. So this is a person, the one you just described, is a person who obviously needs help, but she doesn't want it because she could have fixed this thing. She knew in advance there was going to be a problem, and she didn't do anything about it until she got in trouble. And then she got all concerned, and those are the kind of people right now we have saying, you know, listen, I deserve a bailout. I deserve somebody to give me a job. And they get into that whole deservability thing, and what they really deserve is exactly what they got.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree with you. My attitude about life is you deserve to breathe. You deserve to have water to drink. I mean, you deserve to take care of yourself, period. If that means you're you know, if you need a job, go get a job. If you need to get outside and cut somebody's grass for several months, go cut grass. You know, do whatever it is that you need to do. But I deserve to not have to bail your butt out every time you get in trouble.
Well, I was the president of a company many, many years ago that went bankrupt. And I deserved that bankruptcy. I did some stupid things. I got myself in trouble. And I had a lot of bad things happen. I mean, the state of Oklahoma ruled that what I did for a living was no longer going to be legal. It was in the telecommunications industry, and they didn't grandfather my company. I was the first who did it, but I did a lot of stupid things along the way as well. And so the company went into bankruptcy. I came home as the president of the company with no income, and I thought, I'm in trouble. I got to fix this. And I did just what you said. I went to my neighbors. I was humiliated. I was embarrassed, and I asked to mow their yards. And so here was the guy who last week was the president of the company, and this week he's mowing yards to figure out how to buy food for his family. I did those things. And, yeah, it is embarrassing, but I wasn't entitled to someone to step in and take care of me. I created the mess, I took responsibility for the mess, and then I went about fixing the mess, regardless of what my ego told me I was able to do. I just got out and worked.
Right. And what did you, we're talking about giving things up and getting out of your own way. When you were in that position where all of a sudden you're a millionaire and then you're not in the space of a couple of days, what kind of time, I remember you telling me that story. It was like, ooh, but look where you are now. So you took that as a lesson and did something with it. But what were, if you don't mind sharing, what were some of the chats that you had with yourself at that time? What did you do to get out of your own way?
Well, the first thing you do is you do take responsibility. So you just kind of have to go to the mirror and look yourself in the eye and say, listen, I did this. I can't blame anybody, and so I'm not going to waste my time saying, oh, poor me. I'm going to take responsibility for the mess. And then I did just what I tell everybody to do. I got out a pencil and paper, and I said, what can I physically do to earn money, not a year from now when I find a dream job or when I create my dream job. What can I do to earn money tomorrow? What can I do? And so I started writing down things. And then I started saying, what can I do without right now in our lifestyle? What can we give up? And that's what a lot of people need to do right now. You tell them, give up your premium cable, and they go, what? I can't do that. And then they whine and complain. And, you know, even I, a month ago, I thought, you know, a guy said, have you ever tried to do that? And I thought, you know, I haven't in a good long while. Let me see what I can do. So I called up my cable company. I said, give me a breakdown of these channels, channels I never watched. And
right.
I cut mine $80 a month, and I didn't miss a thing. So it can be done. So you write down what you're going to give up. You write down what you can do tomorrow to earn some money. And then you look at what you got and say, what can I do without here? And you start selling a bunch of crap. That's exactly what I did 25 years ago when I went bankrupt and got in a lot of trouble. And that's what I would tell anybody to do right now. Do those three things. Figure out what you can do to earn some money tomorrow. Figure out what you can give up in terms of your lifestyle, and figure out what you've got that you could sell to earn some cash.
You know, I remember your television show because I was a devotee. I watched that thing every chance I got. And that's what you did with the people you were counseling. You went through their closets and found clothes that, you know, designer clothes with the tag still on them. You said, sell this. You don't need it. You're not going to. I remember that. It's like, oh, my goodness. Look, I went through my closet. My husband was right behind me going, what's in there? What's in there? You know? And we went through my closet. And I found a lot of stuff that I had no need for. Did I need to sell it at the time? No. Was it doing me any good in that closet? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I got rid of a lot of stuff that I flat didn't need. And it was actually cathartic for me.
Absolutely.
You know, I didn't know
it's
why
a very freeing process.
It is. It really is. Give it away, throw it away, you know, gift it to somebody, sell it, just clean house sometimes is what you have to do. But I do remember that from your show. I remember that was something that you always
told them to do. And the process is really so simple. That's not a complicated process. Those three little steps I just outlined, anybody could do those things no matter what your economic level is, no matter whether you have to do it, need to do it. Everybody should go through that process.
Right. I agree. Well, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, and we're talking about, you know, the holidays are coming up. They're not coming up. They're here. I didn't
they
see
are
that
here.
They're here. This year has gone just so fast. But I know that I don't shop, so I'm not really one to speak about this. If it doesn't come to my door from a UPS truck, I don't buy it. It's just that simple. So you're not going to see me in a mall. But I'm hearing reports, you know, from friends and from people that I meet on Facebook that they're really struggling. They're struggling. Their businesses are down, or their, you know, their job is going away or has gone away. But by golly, they're trying to find the money to buy that thing, whatever that thing is, for their child. I would love to hear your comments on that.
Well,
can I put the phone down and cover my ears?
No. You know, and I just wrote a blog about that gave 10 steps on ways to turn your holiday experience around and make it more about love and family and living within your budget. And if people want to read it, they can certainly go to my blog at LarryWinkett.com. But, you know, the first thing you do is you sit down with your kids. If you're trying to save your money and buy something for your kid, you just sit down and talk to them and say, look, it's not like it has been in the past. Things have changed. And make them a part of the family by sharing with them. You know, and the best Christmas I ever created for my kids was 25 years ago when I was flat broke and I had $50 to spend for Christmas. I wrote about this in my book, You're Broke Because You Want to Be. And I went to an Army surplus store, and I spent $50, and they still to this day said, that's the best Christmas we ever had. And it was just stuff I was able to get creative. You can get really creative when you have to. So, number one, just communicate with your family and the other people in your family. You don't have any business buying crap that they don't need for anyway. Mm-hmm. Just talk to them. Tell them what your situation is. They understand. Also, I'm on a real bent this year. I am absolutely anti-electronics. I think that we are creating a society, and, you know, I did write a best-selling parenting book, Your Kids Are Your Own Fault. But we are creating a society of fat, stupid, lazy kids. And nobody can argue that. They find my words offensive, but I'm sorry, I can back every one of those statements up with hard facts, and we all know it. Our kids are fat, stupid, and lazy, and part of it's because we stick electronic stuff in their hands, and we say, there, entertain yourself. When we ought to be doing things like buying them a football, a baseball, a basketball, a bat, a glove, a bicycle, a skateboard, board games, things that they can do outside. You know, I asked my kids when I was writing that book, and then they reinforced that over the Thanksgiving holidays when we were all standing around talking, what the best thing I ever did for them. And my son just had a son, so I now have a grandson, and my other one, they're trying to and all this. And they said, the best thing you ever did, Dad, was kick our butts outside.
Out. Yeah.
And we would come to you and say, but what are we supposed to do? And you would say, I don't care, but you're going to do it outside.
My mother did the same to us. There was a bunch of kids. I was the oldest of 9 kids, and she would say, you go outside. And we'd say, well, there's nothing to do out there. So you know what we did, Larry? There was tall grass at the back of the property, and we had crop circles back in the day before there was such a thing as crop circles. And we would build forts, and we would, you know, create all kinds of just different designs, and we'd be out there all day long without any kind of a toy, just us and our books. She would say, outside, there's your books.
Absolutely.
There's
my
water
kid's
hose
favorite
there,
toy,
God
and I know
bless.
my favorite toy growing up was I loved washing machine boxes. You know what you can do with a washing machine box?
Yeah,
you can cut doors in it and windows in it and make a fort or a house or anything in the world. There's so much you can do for your kids when you force them to go outside. And then, you know, I said this on a radio show just this last week, and a woman said that is a stupid thing to say. It's dangerous outside. Well, absolutely, it could be dangerous in some areas, but for the most part, statistically, that argument cannot be backed up. It just can't be. Yeah. There are very few kids being nabbed off the streets. I'm sorry, it's just not true. And if kids play in big groups, it doesn't happen. And if you communicate the dangers of the world out there, come on. You've put little naive kids out there and say, of course they're going to be susceptible. But for the most part, you can train kids away from a lot of that and just teach them.
Yeah.
Here's a yard. Here's how to stay safe. But go outside and play.
Well, you know, if you can train a dog to stay in the yard, for crying out loud, you can train a child.
Oh, I had a huge argument with a neighbor about that, who would, every time his kids went in the front yard, he put out signs blocking the lane of traffic in front of his house that said, children playing. And he would create huge traffic problems. because he put these cones out there that he had bought on the internet somewhere. And one day I pulled up part between the cones while he's out there with his kids, and I said, stop blocking traffic. He said, my kids are playing in the yard. I said, as long as they play in the yard, nobody's going to drive their car up in the yard and run over them. Mm-hmm. Why don't you keep your kids in your yard so they don't go in the street instead of stopping all the traffic and creating accidents in the street? But that's not how people think.
No, it's not. And you know, that would be a very poor lesson for those children, that they're just so important and they're just so precious that nobody can come near them. That, you know, that parents are going to just circle them with this big protective nonsense circle, but they don't know it's nonsense. I don't think that's healthy.
No, I don't think it's
healthy.
He's
not allowing those children to think or be on their own.
Well, see, but you just said a horrible thing that said we've got to tell our kids that they're special and precious and all that. And one of the premises I wrote in Your Kids Are Your Own Fault is the worst thing we can do is tell our kids how special they are. Because they're special at home, they're special to you because they were born to you and they're yours. They earned that by birthright. But the minute they walk out your door, they're not special to anybody. They're just that little snotty-nosed kid in third row. And they've got to earn their specialness based on their actions and their abilities. It's not a gift that's given to people based on the very fact they exist. You're not special because you exist. In the real world, you're special based on what you do.
And, you know, when you teach children this, and this is just my theory, but when you teach children that, you know, they're just absolutely it, that they're just, you know, the most important thing in the world, I think that that leads later in life to this sense of entitlement that we're seeing so much of. It's actually quite funny.
Gee, you and I get it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I agree.
To be honest with you, I can't stand to be around most kids. I find most of them absolutely obnoxious.
I used to go in restaurants and they'd say smoking or non-smoking. I'd say non-children. And then they would just look at me and I'd say, no kidding, don't put me around other people's kids.
Well, they're
and it's not that I don't love kids. I love kids. I just love well-behaved kids. And I never blame the kid. I always blame the parent. Every time you see an obnoxious little kid, you blame mom and daddy. And every time you see a great kid, I stopped a parent the other day. I scared him to death in a grocery store. I really did because I think they thought
did
I was.
Did they know who you were?
No, they thought I was just some crazy person. But I just kind of followed this daddy around with his little girl, and he was so amazing talking to her about the differences in the vegetables and what they weighed and how you measured them out and weighed them and figured out what they cost and whether that fit the budget. And I watched him for a while, and I walked up and said, excuse me, and really I think he thought I was a crazy. And I said, I just want to compliment you for being such a great dad. You're doing an amazing job. Thank you so much. That will be a great member of society at some point. And he just stood there with his mouth open. But I think we need to start stopping people and saying thank you for being a good parent. We also need to stop people and say, why are you being such an idiot? You're going to ruin your kid.
Well, I have done. I've done both. So I know. In my, I've done both with my car key in my hand, just in case I have to get out quickly.
You need an escape route.
I'm going to say what I have to say, and then I'm running. But you're right, and sometimes people just simply don't understand that that obnoxious little child that is screaming in the aisle of the store is not cute or precious or funny. It is an obnoxious little child.
No, I agree.
But to go back,
but we blame the kid. Sadly, we do. We blame that kid, and it's really his mom and dad's fault.
I blame the parents. I really do. But to go back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, we're raising fat, stupid children, there's a couple of points. I live in a very tiny, you can almost call it a village. It's, you know, we're stuck between sugarcane fields, so it's very quiet. You can hear the church bells ringing. It's a lovely little town. And I live in a little four-street neighborhood. I mean, four streets, that's it. You know, there's one way in, there's one way out. And I was standing at my mailbox yesterday, and I was watching the school bus come in. And my husband had said something about, have you noticed how fat the kids are in this neighborhood? And I really hadn't, because I don't, you know, I don't pay much attention to what's going on out there in the front. I'm always in my office. So I stood there deliberately, and I was reading my mail, and I was watching these kids get off the bus. And these are high school kids from the looks of them. Larry, there was five of them. They got off of that bus. They're all, without exception, overweight. One was obese. Every one of them had a phone in their hand, and they weren't even talking to each other. They're walking in a line, you know, side by side down the road. because they can do that. We don't have sidewalks, but they weren't making eye contact with one another. They were not speaking to one another. Every one of them was playing with an electronic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, they passed me. I just, you know, stood there. I really wanted to see what was going on with these kids. One of them passed me. I could hear his feet dragging on the pavement, on the road. He wouldn't even pick up his own darn feet. These were the most lethargic bunch of kids I've seen, I think, ever. It really just broke my heart.
Typically that's the way it is, though. If you went to any bus stop in America, that's what you would see. We really are raising, for the very first time, a society of children who are not going to outlive their parents simply because we're feeding them too much. And we're killing our kids with French fries and with soda pop. And we somehow have justified that it's okay to do that. And then we pacify them with something electronic in their hand. And that's a darn shame. We haven't taught them how to socialize and how to just as we've been talking about, get outside and play and do some of those things. They don't know how to talk to other people.
I've never seen these kids before. My husband says they've lived here a while. I've never seen them. So that tells you something.
Yeah, they go in their house
they go
and
in the
lock
house,
their door and sit in front of their computers, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
Well, it is that, and really, I think if there's anything that's going to bring our society down, it will be ultimately this, the horrible parenting that has created a society of people who, frankly, they are stupid. They're just not smart. Look at the statistics. We don't compare on an educational level with very many countries anymore. I think we're ranked 27, and that's a darn shame. And we are overweight. We're the fattest society on earth, the dumbest society right now. It's just a shame.
It really is. And, you know, I know, and I'm not faulting the parents. I don't think it's not that they don't love their children. I think they just don't know any better. And they just don't go seek out other avenues to deal with their children.
I think they're fat, stupid, and lazy, too.
Really?
I really do blame the parents. They are. They are fat, stupid, and lazy. Come on. They need, 60% of society is obese, so they're just too lazy to interact with their kids. It's easier not to. You know, American Parenting Association says the average parent spends 3.5 minutes per week in meaningful conversation with their children. So don't tell me you love your kids and then only talk to them 3.5 minutes a week. Sorry. I'm not buying it.
By meaningful conversation, what do you mean?
Well, it's more than here's your Pop-Tart, go to bed, go to your room.
Right.
I mean actually talking to your children about what's going on in their lives, about their friends, about their school, about things with them. That's meaningful conversation. Who are you? What are you interested in? What's going on with you? Not do this, don't do that. Yeah.
Well, and that leads me to something else that you've been talking about a good bit lately, which is bullying. These children are killing themselves because bullies exist everywhere. I mean, I was bullied when I was in school briefly until I lowered my head and stuck it, you know, I just went at a run with my head, you know, perpendicular or parallel to the ground, and I butted this guy in the stomach, knocked him on his butt, and he left me alone after that.
Gee, in other words, you learned to stand up
that day. I knew I was going to die, and I was just going to go out in my own way.
You know, what we forget, you're never going to be able to legislate bullies out of existence. So people say no tolerance. I don't understand no tolerance for bullying. Every business has bullies. I've worked with companies that the 70-year-old receptionist was the biggest bully in the corporation, simply because she could determine whether you got your calls or not. And she knew it, and she had the power. So bullies are everywhere. They come in all shapes, sizes, ages, colors, you name it. They're always going to be with us. What we have to realize is that you can't really have a bully if you're not willing to be a victim. And when you teach your kids, we're trying to teach people not to be bullies. Well, we ought to teach our kids not to be victims. I've seen kids in wheelchairs that were scrawny, that were nerdy little kids, and, you know, people get upset that I label them that way. We just know they're geeky, nerdy little kids. However, they don't get picked on because they know how to carry themselves, how to communicate effectively. You would never think of picking on that person just because they wouldn't allow it. They have a carriage, a confidence the ability to carry themselves in such a way that nobody's going to pick on them. That's because their parents took the time to teach them that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I had read a study one time, well, probably a year or so ago, that indicated that women in particular who are most likely to be mugged or raped are those who do not carry themselves with confidence or, you know, with any kind of strength. I mean, if they're carrying themselves, their shoulders are slumped, they're not really paying attention, and they just have a slightly defeated attitude about life. I think people don't understand that shows. And anybody who is a bully or who is, you know, looking for that particular type of person is going to find you. Now,
the very first time I ever went to New York City many years ago with a friend, and I was truly a rube kid from Oklahoma, and he and I were walking along, and I remember the streets were crowded, and a policeman came up and said, "You two need to get back in a different part of town." And it didn't look like a bad part of town to me. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "You guys are going to get mugged." And I said, "What are you talking about? Look, there's a little old lady over there walking by herself." And he said, "Yeah, and she looks like she knows what she's doing. You guys look like victims." And I went, "Really? Okay." But it was a great lesson for me. Some people look like victims.
They do. They do.
And they are going to be victimized. And so do you blame the bully, or do you blame the fact that the parents of the victims, don't they have some responsibility in this, that they can teach their children not to be victims, to stand up for themselves, to carry themselves in such a way that nobody's going to even think about picking on them? I think that's part of good parenting as well.
Right. And it's just amazing to me that these kids are being bullied in school. You hear these stories. And, you know, these other kids are going on Facebook, beating children up, and, you know, they're putting it on YouTube. Where are those parents? That's what I want to know. Where are the parents of the kids who are doing this kind of stuff? How can they not know what their kids are up to?
Well, that goes back to
the... Seriously, how can they not know?
Parents are just not involved. How can that set of parents not know that their kids had a garage full of weapons before they pulled off Columbine? I mean, come on. It's just a lack of involvement in the lives of your kids. And we've reached the point that we think parental involvement with our children means that we sit on the couch at the same time and watch the same stupid stuff on television. That's involvement, and it's not.
Right. Well, you hear so many stories, and people say, "I just don't understand what happened with my child." Really? Seriously? You don't?
I know.
I
do a lot of these radio shows, and I take call-ins sometimes, and a woman called in the other day and said, "I don't know what's gone wrong. My 17-year-old is out of control." And I stopped her and said, "Well, let me help you with this. I guarantee you, if your 17-year-old is out of control, he was out of control at 17 months old. You just never did anything about it. You just finally got to the point 17 years later that you don't know how to handle it. If you had handled it at 17 months old, you wouldn't be where you are right now." Mm-hmm. Well, she didn't like that at all. But
did she hang up or did she cry?
No, she didn't like it. She said, "No, he was great. No, I promise he wasn't great."
No.
But and sadly, it's real hard to parent in reverse. It can be done, but it's so difficult to go backwards and say, I need to do things differently when you should have been doing them differently for the last 15 years. It's hard to do that. So that's why you kind of got to read my book and start young.
Which book?
Your kids are your own fault.
Okay. I love your books. But you know what I wanted to ask you, too? This is really not about kids. It's about everybody. You know, anybody that has to endure negative comments. You know, we're back to the bullying thing. We all get it. I mean, you get it on Facebook. You know, I'll get now and then from somebody who's supposed to love and adore me, and I'll say, "What? What'd you just say?" But you know, you get them. And I think my attitude is, you cannot tell what it is that they're really saying to you. You can only understand. I mean, you can tell. But you can only understand how you are going to feel about it, and you have to give yourself permission to say, that's your opinion. Good for you. And not take it to heart.
Yeah, there was a book many, many years ago by Terry Cole Whitaker, and the title, you don't even need to read the book, just embrace the title. The title is What You Think of Me Is None of My Business.
There you go. That's what I was trying to say.
And I heard that, you know, really 25 years ago when I first got on my huge personal development thing and I started reading all these books. And it's when I read that book, again, just embrace the title, What You Think of Me Is None of My Business. I have absolutely no impact on, I can't help what other people say. I just can't.
Right.
You can't either. None of us can. If they're going to form their opinions based on their history, their biases, their training, their belief system, I have nothing to do with that. I can react, and I get to choose how I react. And mostly what I do is I make it about them. I just don't let them get to me. Of course, sometimes it does. You know, I'm not impervious to pain. And people say really hurtful things. Again, I do get horrible things said about me simply because once you draw a line in the sand and make your beliefs clear, people are going to put you down for those beliefs, regardless of what they are, by the way. They're going to. So you just kind of got to get used to it, understand that it's better to stand for something, and you got to get over what other people say about you.
Well, you know, I arrived at that conclusion many, many years ago, and like you, I've been accused, you know, various terms and conditions, if you will, of being cold or unemotional or detached, and I'm not by a long shot, but I'm not going to delve into your mental illness. And sometimes some of the things that look like mental illness to me actually are. But, you know, my attitude about, and this title is so spot on, my attitude is I cannot possibly understand what you're thinking when you say or do something that may or may not be hurtful to me, and I can't understand, I don't want to understand, to be honest with you. You know, you said it, it's your position now, but 5 minutes down the road, your position may be something different. Our thoughts are constantly in flux. And I think that's what people kind of forget. You may be thinking, oh, man, I am going to take that cat outside and I'm going to whoop it. And then the next morning, oh, I love you. So, I mean, we're all so changeable. You can't take a moment in time like that and assume that that's permanent. It's written in concrete. Yeah, it's hurtful, but it's still their thought. It's not mine. And
absolutely,
that's the only way I can live. So
I'm
in control of my thoughts.
I just choose not to participate in somebody else's drama.
There you go. That's how I live my life. And, you know, like I say, I get accused of being a little detached every once in a while. I'd rather be detached than nuts. So,
you know, I have people write me all the time, and they say, how dare you say that you don't care? And I don't care.
You do.
What I mean is I don't care that you have an issue with what I have to say. I don't care. Right. I do what I do. Because it's the right thing for me to do. People say, don't you feel responsible when people do well? And I say, no, and I don't feel responsible when people do poorly. I have nothing to do with them. That's their journey. That's their experience. Those are their lessons. I can't learn them for them. I've got to take care of myself, and it makes me a true hedonist. I make myself happy. I do what I do because it's the right thing for me to do, and I have to let everybody else have their own experience.
Exactly. And by you taking care of yourself and being the healthiest, strongest, best person you can possibly be, that just automatically translates into you're able to help other people, whether they know it or not, or whether they need it or not.
Absolutely.
You know, if you are
not good
you are
for
strong,
anybody else until you're first good for yourself. You've got to be good
exactly.
for yourself.
Right. And I don't find that hedonistic. I find that we could call it that or healthy selfishness, but you must take care of yourself.
Yep.
And this standing around and waiting for other people to take care of us is, to me, just utter nonsense. I mean, it's complete and total nonsense, and I hate that this is happening in our country.
Well, when my wife and I first got married, I had inscribed inside of a ring, I'll always take care of you. And about 10 years in, I didn't. And we had some real rocky places in our marriage about 10 years in. Now, I'm celebrating my anniversary tomorrow of 28 years. But about 10 years in, as a lot of couples do.
Congratulations.
We just messed up. I appreciate that. And so what I did was I went in and I had that, and she handed me the ring. She said, I don't think you're always taking care of me. And it really... It made me think. And I went in and had that taken out of the inside of her wedding ring. And I had it replaced with love, honor, and respect. And I said, you know, I will always love you, I will always honor you, and I will always respect you. But I understand now I can't take care of you. Not the way you expect, not the way I expect, because it means something totally different. And what we shouldn't do is expect someone else to take care of us. In a relationship, we can expect their honor, their respect, and their love, but we can't expect anybody else to ever show up and just take care of us. It's not fair to either person.
Well, and you know that when you say relationship, I would translate that to mean all relationships. And
oh, absolutely.
Love everybody,
yeah.
But you know, do your best to be honorable. You know, do your best to be honest. Do your best to be supportive when necessary or when needed. But you know, don't just bend over backwards to take care of other people or expect it for yourself. I mean, you know how I describe it to myself, Larry? Who does my breathing for me? I do.
Yeah.
Nobody can do my breathing or my thinking or anything else for me, really. I have to do it all. And
yeah.
I don't even mean I have to do it all. I want to do it all. I am me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be less of me if I had somebody else taking care of me or the government taking
care
of me.
I agree.
I wouldn't be me anymore. So,
I think a little selfishness is a good thing. We have to take care of ourselves. See, that's the whole problem with motivation.
Yeah.
Motivation comes from without, and that's why I don't call myself a motivational speaker, and I don't believe in all that motivational mumbo-jumbo stuff that's out there.
Right.
Because motivation requires somebody else or some other thing to show up and flip your switch. Well, what if it doesn't? What if it doesn't show up? What if they don't show up? You've
what
got
if you don't
to be
recognize
able to
it
do
when
it
yourself. Does show up?
Sorry?
What if you don't recognize it when it does show up? What if it's so
exactly.
busy angsting that you don't know what it was? So.
Well, you're always relying on, when you have that kind of thinking, you're always relying on something outside of yourself to do the work for you. And I just can't buy that. I do think that's what's created a sense of entitlement, that's created unhealthy relationships that we, you know, the worst thing ever said was in all those stupid movies when somebody showed up and said, "You complete me." Really? How sad for you.
I know.
In fact, I am really seriously doing a new relationship book. I don't know at what point it will come out. And the title is "You Do Not Complete Me."
I love
and, it. Because I don't think anybody other than yourself can complete you. I think that we've created this enabling society where I have to have somebody else to be happy or I have to have something outside of me to be happy. No, you don't. And if you do, I'm sorry, you're sad. Weak, crippled individual in your emotions.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I saw that same movie, and I have to say, I just kind of went, "Oh God!"
Really? Didn't it just make you want to barf?
It did. I'm not the most romantic person in the world, but I heard that and I went, "Oh, for God's sake!" I really.
Oh,
did.
I know. Actually, I am kind of a romanticist. I mean. And I am, while most people think of me as a true jerk, I mean, I cry at Old Yeller.
Me too.
But sometimes you just hear lines like that and go, really? Come on.
I cried in E.T. I have my moments when I'm human. But, Larry, you have got a new comic book coming. I think it's out. Is your comic book out yet?
Yeah, it's out. It's not out in hard copy. It's out online,
okay.
Which the bulk of the sales will come in. Comic books these days are pretty much downloadable. So it is downloadable.
Right.
And it's they can find out more about it at LarryWingate.com. It's based on my first bestseller, Shut Up, Stop Whining, and Get a Life. A company called Smarter Comics decided that they would release a line of personal development business books in comic book format, which would take 250 pages, drive it down to 50 pages, and reach a different audience. And I'm sorry, it is the dumbing down of America, but there's an audience that will respond better to a lot of pictures in 50 pages than are ever going to sit down and actually read a 250-page book. So in that way, it's genius and will reach a lot of people. And they've done such a good job with my comic. Mine was the first one that they released. They said it was the title alone ought to make it a good comic book. And plus, just my appearance lends itself to a comic book version.
No, come on.
I've always wanted to be a superhero. So this worked out well for me. So
well,
the comic is really cool.
You are a superhero. So
well,
where can
at least
people
in my
find
own
you on
mind.
The web? Well, trust me, it's not just your mind. A lot of people really, really like what you have to say, even if we don't always agree, which is the beauty of. I mean, it's rare that you'll come up with something that I'll just go, I don't know about that, but it makes me think. Which is,
you know,
always,
and that's always been my goal. I sometimes take the other side just to get people to think. And my goal has never been to get everybody to agree with me. My goal has always been to get people to think based on what I have to say. And if you have to think about it and will look inside or outside for answers, then I think I've done my job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you're telling me you don't want to be president then?
You know, first, they asked me the other day, I was doing Fox News, and they said, Larry, when are you going to run for president? I said, never. First of all, it'd be a cut in pay. But secondly, and then the guy said, well, I don't know, Larry, do you know what those ex-presidents get paid to speak? And I said, do you know what I get paid to speak?
But, and you haven't compromised your principles.
I just, you know, people have skeletons in their closets. I have a warehouse full. And I'm just not that politically correct. I would never get along, and I'm not taking out my earrings or taking off my cowboy boots, so I don't think it'd work.
Well, darn. I was hoping.
No, so not trying to make very many people happy. I just do what I do, and people can choose to agree with it or not agree with it. I'm cool either way. I'll keep doing what I do.
Well, and I hope you do. Will you ever have another TV show again? Because I love it.
You know, we're real close on a new deal, and I've been close on a couple of other deals, and there are more stories about the TV industry. It's a strange industry, and you know, there are lots of pilots get shot and don't go to series. But the new deal that we're working on right now looks really good. It's a good fit for me. And now we're just waiting on final network sign-off, and people will start seeing it. So,
Let me know. Be sure to let me know when it comes on.
I'm sure when you see it on Facebook,
you'll know.
I'll blast it everywhere when it's when I get the line.
Well, you know what I wanted to ask you, too, and I can't remember if we've chatted about this before. I don't think so, but I know you worked with a lot of people during your television show, and you know some of them had some real, real problems. Were you ever able to follow up with any of those people, and did they do well, or did they just go, oh, well, thanks for the help, I'm going to go do what I always did?
You know, the feedback, and people, they got so much notoriety for being dumb, frankly, that some of them really were upset. You know, when a network shoots a series, they'll air it forever, and they have the right to air it forever. And so they put these poor people's faces on television, you know, a dozen times, being stupid. And so they sort of became celebrities in their own right. And so some of them were very reluctant to let us follow up with them. Some of them did, though. From what we figured out, about a third of the couples I worked with got divorced, which was a good thing, in my opinion. They never should have been together. They were toxic. So it was okay. About a third of the people went right back to the way they were, and about a third of the people actually changed their lifestyle and were able to do okay. There are a few couples that still write me, like once a year, just to tell me how they're doing and that they're sticking with it, or that they've slipped and now they're back on track. Mm-hmm. So a few will go ahead and stay in contact with me on their own. So.
Well, and do you find that they did it because they wanted to be on TV, or did they really want the help? Not need the help, want the help. Do you happen to know what some of the motivation was for them? Because I watched a few of these. I remember looking at my husband going, oh, my God, I can't believe these people are allowing cameras anywhere near them. Oh, my God.
Oh, I know. Isn't it amazing? People will let a camera into their lives because they want their 15 minutes, believe me. And we gave them 22 minutes. That's how long a 30-minute series is, that you get 22 minutes of fame. And, some of them I really did believe that they did it just so they could be on TV. But they did have real problems. I mean, my show was really, truly reality TV. This was their real situation. We did go through their credit reports and their bills to figure out where they really were. We did talk to everybody in their lives, from the people they owed, landlords, to people in their family. So they were real problems, real people with real problems. But some of them did just want to be on television, I think.
Yeah, I kind of thought that about one or two of them, and I thought, oh, my goodness. I guess my concern about any reality show, not just yours, but any reality show, is that you kind of show your hind end on these things.
And
they can come back to bite you in ways that you can't even possibly think of, and I'm just astonished that anybody will do some of these shows. It's just, I don't
know. Well, you know, it sounds great, and that's sort of the similar feedback that we got from time to time, was that it sounds great, I'm going to have a guy come in, I'll show people can learn. Right. And there were some people willing to let us into their lives just so they could learn, and so other people could learn from their stupid mistakes. And while their intentions were very, very good, people sometimes do forget that's going to be around forever. You know, I posted some of the clips this week on Facebook of people. Now, I'm sure those people didn't understand that those clips were going to be on the Internet and that they would never, ever going to go away.
Go away. That's right. And that's the whole YouTube thing right now. If you make any kind of mistake, especially if you're a politician these days, YouTube is kind of our friend, but in other ways, YouTube is, oh, my goodness, bad. So it really depends on what you're up to. There's cameras everywhere. There's, you know, cell phones everywhere. You know, it might pay to mind your P's and Q's these days.
Oh, I know. I know. I just know that somebody's going to stick a cell phone in my face sometime when I'm unhappy about something. And there it'll be. But that makes me think maybe I shouldn't be unhappy about that situation.
There you go.
I don't think anything I did, though, at this point would surprise my fan base very much, so I'm not much worried about it.
Probably not. No, not a bit. Well, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you'd like to chat about? I mean,
appreciate the opportunity. If people want to know more, I can suggest they go to my website, which has lots of information on my blog. And if people want to, read the 5 books that changed my life, there's a blog on that. I do have blogs on bullying and money and holiday shopping, you name it. You can find out more information about the comic book. My book, Your Kids Are Your Own Fault, will be released in paperback first week of January. So I'll be doing a lot of PR coverage on that. And people can also just go to the website or sign up on Facebook and find out about my television appearances and what show I'm going to be on that day and so forth.
Well, that's how I know, you know, your Facebook fan page is where I know to go find you on Cavuto or, you know, wherever you're going to be. And off I go. I say, ooh, there's Larry.
There you go. I'm doing one today.
Yeah. So, you know, I like to watch those things because, listen, I don't know if people are really, really going to take responsibility for themselves. I am praying that they will. But I think it's a day-by-day, step-by-step, moment-by-moment decision or, you know, process. And you know, I'm just glad you're there to help. Because
well,
people
I appreciate
do take
that.
Personal responsibility.
I do appreciate that. I tell people not to worry too much about tomorrow. Take care of the moment. If you're doing the right thing in the moment, if you're not spending money that you don't have, if you're doing a good job right now with your kid, that's about all you can do is just take care of right now. And if more people got concerned about right this minute, tomorrow would be okay.
Well, you know, and that leads me to people who tend to dwell in the past, which I think is another mistake. I mean, don't get me wrong. I look to the past for lessons, but I don't live there. You know, I live now. So
you know, the most often repeated line in the entire Bible is, "And it came to pass." We need to be reminded of that. It didn't come to stay. It came to pass.
To pass. Exactly.
It's gone. You can't do anything about it except learn from it. You can't really even apologize for it or fix it or do anything about it. It's done. It's over. All you can do is move forward. I think the best word, and we talked about the dirtiest four-letter word, is work. The best four-letter word is next. And we just need to say, what are we doing next? What's the next thing? Whether you're being successful or whether you're being stupid and you've made mistakes, what are you going to do next? What's the next thing you're going to do about it? Teach your kids about it. Okay, next.
You know, one of the things that I hear a lot is, well, you just can't make changes, you know, that quickly. People just don't change. I believe they can, and I believe they do.
I've been saying it for years, Denise. People can change on a dime.
On a dime.
You just change the way you think. You just change. Sometimes you're forced to change. I mean, people say, oh, my life doesn't change that quickly. Okay, let's say somebody close to you dies. Your life changed in a moment. And you can do the same thing within your own life. You can kill off an area of your life in a moment and say, I'm not going to be that way anymore. People do it all the time because they make the decision to do so. The trouble is they give themselves those easy way outs that and offer themselves those cliches. Well, things don't change overnight. Yes, they do. Your life changes overnight all the time. You lose your job, someone dies, something bad happens, a tornado takes your house away, a fire. People's lives change overnight all the time. You can create that kind of a change in your life if you're willing to take responsibility for it, make the decision to do it, and then take action on a new way of thinking.
Right. And I can't even tell you how much I agree with that. I mean, it's I've done it in my own life. I'm doing it today. I'm doing every minute. I'm making changes. I'm growing. I'm evolving. I'm not worried about the past, and I'm not really worried about the future. I'm living right now. And I think that's one of the big lessons that I've taken away from your books.
Well, I appreciate that. All we got right now, just do the best you can with what you got.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, Larry, thank you so much for being with me here today. I always love chatting with you. I feel like we could just go on for another couple of hours.
I appreciate it. Call back. We'll do it anytime you want.
I would love to maybe in a couple months get you back on the show. I would love to, but I've really enjoyed your company and your wisdom, and I know our audience has enjoyed it as much as I have, and you've given a lot of information as usual, and I really thank you. So thank you, everybody, for being here. The show will be available for download in about an hour. And, Larry, if I don't chat with you between now and Christmas, I wish you a very Merry Christmas.
I appreciate that. You have a good holiday, too.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, and have a great week, and I will see you next week. Bye, Larry.